Welcome to The Urban Complex, a system of interrelated, emotion-charged ideas, feelings, memories, and impulses. This name takes the definition and lays out what a listener should expect. A podcast where ideas, feelings, and memories collide, leading towards meaningful change. I'm co-host Chris Richardson. Please enjoy the journey with The Urban Complex. Smarter cities for a stronger tomorrow.
Welcome to The Urban Complex. All opinions by Chris Richardson, Dominic Papa, and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Arizona State University or Amazon Web Services. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon for any decisions. Any endorsement of or messages from sponsors are solely supporting the production of this podcast. There is no further relationship with the podcast purposes than the sponsors unless separately created with another entity. Enjoy The Urban Complex. Smarter cities for a stronger tomorrow.
All right, Chris, how's it going, man? What's top of mind for you?
Well, I think it's probably the same for you. We always talk about here how we want to get out and meet people and go to conferences again. We miss that. But then we just got back from the ASU GSV event, ASU Arizona State University and GSV Global Silicon Valley. I think this is your first one you've been to. I know you've been out in San Diego and it's been going on. I don't think you ever went. And I love the conference. It's like 5,000 folks. Third higher ed and K-12 innovators, a third ed tech that want to change the landscape, and a third of either corporates or private equity or venture capital that wants to make money from changing the world. So and it's just great. Like we've always said, you know, whether you're meeting over coffee or over a beer, meeting people and solving things and getting new information and just pushing the envelope. I don't know. That's me. I'm just on a thrill. But I'm
I mean, it was so much fun just to be in a conference setting around that many people. It was just really fun to get back into it. And I mean, I don't know about you, but I just found it so inspiring listening to so many people and so many prominent, really high, you know, value leaders talk about the future of education and where they see education going in 10 years. I mean, listening to Dr. Crow speak up on stage, it was just incredible to listen to where he thinks education will be in 10 years. So it was just invigorating to get back out there. And so, yeah, it was a lot of fun. I had dinner with my, you know, Jimmy Choi from ASU, one of my good friends. It felt good again to be back amongst fellow innovators and doers.
And some of those people I have seen now for 4 out of the last 6 years. I didn't go in August. I didn't go the 1 year of COVID. And so it's just fun to have built that relationship through that vehicle. To your point, like Tom Friedman was up there with Michael Crow. John Doerr, one of the most prominent venture capital, he was talking about with Kleiner Perkins. He was talking about kind of climate action and whatnot. So yeah, it was amazing stuff going on.
Yeah. Well, hopefully more of those to come, right?
Yeah.
So, all right, let's get to our guest, who we got today.
Well, still in the vein of Arizona State University, we have my boss, Lev Gonick, CIO of ASU. So I'm just really excited. I know he's been doing amazing things at university and with surrounding cities for a long time. We had Dorothy from Digital C on, and I know Lev kind of get that up and running with her a long time ago. I know we're going to hear quite a bit about what's going on at ASU and in the Valley and with telecommunications. So it should be extremely knowledgeable and educational for everyone.
Yeah, this is going to be a lot of fun. Yeah, I've known Lev, it seems like almost forever now, since I was running my nonprofit here and he was actually running Digital C, and we were connected through the U.S. Ignite Smart Gigabit Communities Initiative. So we've become friends a long time ago. He's one of my best friends, colleagues, and mentors. So this is going to be a great conversation. Should we bring him in?
Let's do it.
All right, here he comes.
Support for this episode of The Urban Complex comes from Worldwide Technology.
What if we could connect people to new possibilities, turn thinking into a way forward, solve problems before they become a problem, and share the future with everyone? We can. At WWT, we connect businesses to technology to make the impossible possible, to reach better decisions faster, to accelerate progress. Together, let's make a new world happen.
Lev, please let Dom and I give you a warm welcome to the podcast, The Urban Complex. Thanks for joining.
Great to be with you both, especially on a gorgeous day.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. We've found that the best way to get started is just to kind of open things up generally for people to learn about our guests. So why don't you share a little information about your background, kind of what do you want the podcast audience to know about you as a person and how you got to where you are today, and just kind of hold off on the ASU side and smart city stuff. We'll get to that soon. So,
sure. Yeah, no problem. And again, thanks to you and your podcast listeners. So I'm Lev Gonick. I'll just say for right now that I have a day job. It's the chief information officer at Arizona State University. I have spent most of my professional life in the university setting. Before I started working, I was a PhD student and wrote my PhD on the introduction of new technologies into mining communities. So the topic we're going to talk about today is something I've been working on and thinking about for, let's just say, a very long time. Having spent as much of my professional life in the university setting, I've always been interested in the relationship between universities and their cities, and how a university can be the best neighbor a city has by leveraging all of the assets the university has, including their technological ones, to advance the priorities of the community. And along my journey, I actually started up a nonprofit in my former hometown of Cleveland, Ohio. The nonprofit was called One Community. We evolved into an organization called Digital Sea. It's still alive and well there. And its focus was really on serving, supporting, and advancing the underserved parts of the city, specifically with respect to broadband and broadband access. And then more recently, in the last 5 years, I've been hanging out here in Arizona.
Yeah, so let's talk about that. What do you want the audience to know about Arizona State University? They may not know. And just your role as a CIO, I think it's really interesting. And by the way, Dorothy was great. We got a little background in Digital Sea about 6 months ago now. Yeah.
Yeah, Dorothy's great. And Digital Sea is doing great things in Cleveland. Arizona State University is a very large institution. Scale matters a lot to the way actually Arizona State University is designed. I think a lot of CIOs of big research universities generally actually view the mission as actually serving a fairly selective student body. Think of the great universities that are out there, you know, Michigan, Ohio State, where I went, and so forth, and UCLA. I mean, most of those students, and there are lots of them, tens of thousands, are actually all A students at Arizona State University. By our mission, we're committed to actually supporting a much broader range of students with respect to their preparation for college. And more importantly than just admitting them, we're committed to actually seeing how they, supporting how they actually will succeed in a university setting. And that's certainly something that's been enormously attractive to many of us at Arizona State University. The other thing to share is that about 14 years ago, my colleague Phil Regeer was given the task by President Crow to start up an ASU online idea. It was an interesting moment in time because it was actually just around the 2008-2009 meltdown, and the state of Arizona at the time was in serious retrenchment mode. And so the university faced a challenge with respect to a major source of investment because of that retrenchment. And so President Crow and Phil Regeer actually had this brainstorm way ahead of the industry to actually lean into online learning. And I think in the first cohort, Phil tells me that there were 400 students. And the reason I'm sharing that with you both is because today, you know, we passed 80,000, and that's really literally in 14 years. So hats off to Phil Regeer, but and to President Crow's vision. But it is absolutely a part and parcel of what, you know, a technology leader does to try to contribute to the scale of an institution that has over 150,000 learners today pursuing 400 undergraduate degrees in not only campuses here in Phoenix, but with facilities in Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., in Yuma, Arizona, And actually very, very soon opening up in Mesa here in the metro area, brand new, very technologically savvy campus in downtown Mesa. So the role of the CIO has responsibility for making sure that operationally all the aspirations of the institution and all of its mission can be advanced in the ways that, again, focus in on learner success and obviously a very robust research agenda. And at the same time, trying to catalyze innovation to actually lay down tracks for where the university might go in the future. And some of your listeners may have heard of very ambitious programs that we have at ASU. For example, the Thunderbird School of Global Management, ranked number one in the world, has just put down a small sort of a challenge out there to actually engage 100 million learners around the world in curricular content focused in on entrepreneurship in 40 different languages. And Chris, you know too well, that has just a little bit to do with technology. Obviously, you know, that's all part of, you know, the great ambition of ASU. And, you know, I could go on for a very long time on that topic.
Just a few things going on around here.
Yeah, all in day's work, right? the size, scale, and impact is just incredible. So, Lev, let's take a step back. You mentioned in the introduction kind of your interests in looking at the university and its impact and influence on cities. So, as you know, this is a Smart City podcast. We've had a little bit of fun asking all of our guests kind of what's your view, what's your definition of smart cities, what's working, what's not, and then how do you bring that view into your role as a CIO for ASU?
Sure. So, you know, the way I've always viewed the conversation is actually a modification. Again, it's fallen out of favor because we all like to have highly contracted buzzwords today. But I have always thought that smart and connected communities, you know, it has been the way I framed it. And by that, I mean not just different words, but to actually underscore the importance that for any community, any city to be smart, it actually needs to also be connected. And connected doesn't just mean with broadband. It also means actually engaging in strategies for a smart and connected health strategy and a smart and connected education strategy and a smart and connected workforce development strategy. And of course, not trivially, a smart and connected government services strategy that are out there. And I think what we've done at ASU and you know, your partner in crime here, Chris Richardson, you know, has done really been one of our great champions of this work. It's also done to model what does a smart and connected campus look like, especially one the size of ASU, in which we can actually essentially create living labs, plural, of the ways in which we can do smart and connected campus activity as a prototype or as a series of places to test both the technology as well as very important conversations, for example, you know, around privacy and the ethics of actually using technology to do some of the surveillance, again, small s surveillance work that goes on, but can't be a capital S kind of surveillance in the sense that it's spooky, which is to say without, obviously, we work very hard, and Chris, again, has led the team, to focus in on getting consent, and not just consent once, but routinely reminding folks what it is that we're collecting and asking them if it's okay if we continue. And by default, actually, not turning on those services until they tell us, yes, I think it could actually help me with a better experience. And we think we've had lots of conversations with cities who are really intrigued because I think the first series of sort of enthusiasm about this being all about technology is now beginning to sort of settle down into an intelligent conversation about basically how to get the balance right between that which the technology can do, the priorities that the community has, and the balance of the values that we have in society around things like our privacy and our confidentiality that we'd like to have, at least in certain circumstances, and to be able to be forgotten if that's what we want to do in terms of you know, our mobile phones and so forth for specific experiences or, for that matter, our laptops.
Yeah, and those are very difficult conversations and, you know, kind of topics for cities to advance by themselves. So it sounds like ASU, the university, especially with the smart campus efforts, it can be kind of a living laboratory, a test ground. It's a learning.
Change is easy, right, Dom?
Yeah, right, exactly. But that's what it sounds like. It sounds like, you know, the university, it's more kind of suited to tackle and test these hard, you know, have these hard conversations like privacy, but then the cities can learn from it. It sounds like that's kind of how you're using the university and the campus.
Very, very much so, Dom. And, you know, some of, you know, our colleagues, you know, we tested the idea, like could we actually put together an ethics committee of faculty and students before we kind of magically provided them with a technology framework, asking them to actually help us frame the policy. And, you know, and the debates were vigorous. And I think, you know, they continue to, we constantly are revisiting them with our products and services that are out there. And we think that's a really good model for government when cities in particular think about rolling out services. That, you know, in the past, cities have had, you know, the role of an ombudsperson being, you know, not all cities do, but many cities have an ombudsperson as part of the work. And that, you know, that is oftentimes kind of where the complaint department goes. But if we kind of modernize and digitize the ombudsperson's role, it would be to actually help facilitate and invite a standing committee. For example, in hospitals around really difficult medical decisions, every hospital has a medical ethics committee. There's a reason for it. And I think cities should at least think about a similar kind of approach, which is, you know, a standing committee, which is ad hoc in the sense that it gets together only when there needs to be, you know, an engagement, including setting down, you know, some broad parameters. And it should be very diverse. And as good medical, by the way, ethics committees are as well, not just quote unquote experts. And guide our work that way, so, and tell the story, create narratives around the story of why it's important to engage the community in the ways in which you know, we want to advance smart and connected cities.
Yeah, that's awesome. I love this idea of using the university not just for the tech aspect of it, but also the processes. Right, what processes can we adopt from the university or test on the university that then we can kind of transform and take to the cities. That's phenomenal. Lev, so, you know, part of our audience, a lot of them are just maybe starting out in their smart city journeys. We, Chris and I have talked to a lot of mayors out there that are just starting to get in to smart cities, standing up their smart city program, hiring a director. Let's go back just a little bit. As Chris mentioned, we had Dorothy on from Digital C, and you obviously starting that with One Community that transformed into Digital C. Talk to us why did you start the nonprofit? What was the impetus behind it? And how did it help maybe the city really drive some of those difficult challenges in Cleveland?
Well, I mean, I think, and I did actually listen to Dorothy's podcast with you when it came out 6 months ago or so. And I think, you know, her version of the story is also my version of the story. And, you know, Cleveland, like a lot of cities, especially in the Northeast and the Midwest, are legacy cities. I mean, they have cities in which, unlike us here in the desert, there's a real challenge to deal with earlier generations of wealth generation, industry, pollution, neighborhood development that was all associated with sort of support, public transportation systems. All these things that were critically important to the industrial age are now legacy as we enter into the digital age. And our point of view was, and still is, not only in Cleveland, but elsewhere, that no matter what a city's future is, it at the time, 15 years ago, we were working hard to make the case, but now, it's I think, largely understood, no matter what the future is, every city actually has an opportunity to actually craft the blueprint for its digital future as an enabler of probably most, if not, yes, most of the most highest priorities, education and health, workforce development and economic prosperity, health and wellness activities. We've certainly learned, through COVID that we actually, we could actually pull most of this off. Again, hardly perfect, but we could certainly pull this off. Those were the early impulses that we had in a city that was creaking under the weight of the legacy economy, the legacy leadership, the sort of serious antipathy to technology. Not that everyone was a Luddite, but seriously kind of going, you know, maybe this technology thing is just a passing fad and it'll just kind of... that happens in a lot of legacy cities. And most of the leaders, you know, over the last 10 or 15 years have said, well, maybe this technology thing is actually here to stay, but it'll be for the next generation of leaders to tackle these issues. And so I think we sit at a very interesting moment in, again, my former home city of Cleveland. A very and young, talented new mayor has been elected. And is running and leaning into a smart and connected city strategy. Again, I think as an enabler at near the top of his overall priority list.
That's awesome.
That's great. Hey, so let's set the stage for now all the great work here in Arizona. So tell us a little about why the move to Arizona and ASU get such a great reputation in Cleveland. Help set the stage for why you're here now.
Oh, well, I mean, I've had a relationship with ASU. I'm old enough to share with you that I was on a sabbatical here in 1993 as a professor. So, as I said, I've spent most of my life in the university setting. And since then, I've maintained a relationship, mostly fairly casual, from time to time doing a consulting gig. I was approached by a search firm that said, ASU was looking for a CIO. Having had a really terrific run at Case Western Reserve University, my former university home, and having brought Digital C, I think, to a really good place in terms of its creating an endowment, which was my goal, creating an endowment so that the organization could have a very long, prosperous capacity to deliver its mission. I felt like it was a good opportunity to at least ask the more important part of our family, my wife, whether or not she was ready for a new adventure. And Barb was generous and said, this sounds like a really good opportunity. Michael Crow, as he does regularly, closed the deal. It's been a real fun run for our family here and to get to know the community here.
You said you've had a long-term relationship with ASU. Is it true that my colleague John Rome may have overchecked you in basketball like 25 years ago, but it didn't bother him? He's still here doing partnerships, right?
I still have the bruises on my ribs, Chris. If we were video casting, I would share that with you. John was a vicious. John was vicious in the midday pickup basketball game on the Tempe campus, and had the sharpest elbows. I know he denies all of that, but that's the truth. And I've known John. I've known several of the other folks at ASU for, again, what is now almost 28 years. Great colleagues, great IT group here, terrific faculty community, and really, I think, the world's most ambitious leadership team.
Cool. Well, you've definitely been making waves since you've arrived. Let's start with a story around next generation connectivity. How did you see that opportunity? Where is it today? Where do you think it's taking shape in the future? Where's it going?
Well, again, let me just sort of say there's a campus version of that, and then there's a community version of that. And actually, that's what the next generation network strategy has been. Don't just build an infrastructure that is in a remote kind of way only for the campus. Try to figure out how to architect technically a network that can do an and both rather than an either or approach to network design. And so, we have pivoted to really, I think, rather than being I guess, a quick follower in terms of network infrastructure, which is how I would describe ASU when I arrived. I think we're back out in front with really trying to help not only architect a campus network that can support the needs of our community, because that aligns to ASU's mission, but also to make sure that our researchers have world-class networks that can support network-enabled research, which is, again, one of the fastest-growing parts of the National Science Foundation investment, which is really important to any city that has a university in it, is to actually figure out how to drive network-enabled research. Much of it can be applied research in the community. That is to say that we can partner with the community, whether that's on sustainability issues and the basically monitoring of air quality particulates and other kinds of activities that are going on as part of our, not only of our science, but also of our engagement with the community, just as one small example of the kind of work that, if it's integrated end to end, provides, I think, a very robust infrastructure for the institution, and at the same time advances the community's needs. So I'd say, Chris, on that one, Next Generation Network is about, it's based on a technology which is called software-defined networks. Most of the world of technology has been software-defined. Networks, for a lot of interesting legacy reasons, were not until relatively recently. And so ASU is at the very front end of a software-defined network, which allows us, and most importantly here, to provide management that extends across the campus in very robust ways using code, rather than actually having to copy and paste syntax to keep networks up and going. And we have a great technology partner in Arista for that work going forward. And we're also partnering with them across all of Arizona and the Sun Corridor Network, which is Arizona's research and education network, which is, along with Siena, which is a very important technology partner that we have as well, and trying our level best to make sure that that design extends out into the community, leveraging multiple wireless technologies, millimeter wave technologies, CBRS technologies, also using LoRaWAN technologies for supporting monitoring of basically telemetry or devices that don't need high power. And again, just to connect that to Dom's earlier question, Chris, like that started here on the campus with your team. And now, we can and are building out LoRaWAN networks just across the valley.
Awesome. Awesome. I love that idea of, bringing the connectivity into the community. And naturally, that then starts to lead to a conversation around digital equity. And, you've been a strong advocate, a national leader for the voice of digital equity. Talk to us about your views of digital equity. What are you trying to achieve? And how does improved connectivity really kind of help what you do and what you have planned to do in the future?
Yeah, Dom, I mean, what I'd say is, I part of it is sort of just a broad sort of philosophical view as to why working on equity issues matter. For me personally, it's part of a much longer arc of my interest, which is really on studying poverty. Hmm. And the origins of poverty, which is kind of where I spent a lot of my academic life, and then figuring out solutions to figuring out how to help folks out of what is not just an economic state of being, but is also, can be significantly complicated at the family unit level or the neighborhood level and so forth. When I got into digital equity work, it was, again, in the early, mid-80s, in the 1987, I began work in Africa on helping build networks. I mean, this is obviously before, the World Wide Web. So that, again, that was 1993 was the web. This is back in the 87. And the challenge was that there were real issues facing communities, that tuberculosis in Southern Africa was rampant. It ended up being an early kind of canary in the coal mine for AIDS and communities, clinics all over that sub-Sahara, well, actually, you know, in the southern part of the continent, really had no capacity to actually share testing of X-rays. And so, you know, I along with a group of other folks, started working on what became known as first MangoNet and then HealthNet to really try to figure out how to serve those remote villages and their healthcare clinics to be able to share data with healthcare professionals through, again, pre-internet protocol. So not before TCP/IP. This was actually, a protocol that required us to do dial-up and polling. We wrote the software out of a group out of Toronto, wrote the software so that it could pull from the village, try a phone call to the capital. It would try 99 times because connectivity was really anything but given in terms of being able to do a handshake. Once it connected, it would actually upload all of the content that needed to be uploaded. And if it broke, it would, again, go back through the whole thing. And then after it uploaded, it would download everything. And from the capital, those bits traveled to South Africa. And from South Africa, they exited the continent and went to actually the UK. And this was all, again, pre-internet protocol. And from there, Swedish International Development Agency and Canadian International Development Agencies got them to doctors. And for me, that was about kind of, all right, how to help people work their way through, you know, what ended up being obviously and still is for many a very serious health pandemic. And from then, I've often thought about what lessons did I learn in my years in Africa, and I also did work similarly in India. What work did I learn from those communities about how to use technology that can actually then be adopted and used in our communities here? And that's certainly been, you know, all of the work in my professional life has been to try to advance here in urban Phoenix or certainly in Cleveland and Southern California, where I lived before I went to Cleveland. I'm always working on trying to figure out how to leverage technology to attend to either the crisis or the priority of the day. How do we work together to not only support our digital equity needs here, but, you know, there's a crisis going on in Ukraine. What can we do there to use technology to help what is going to be, what is already one of the largest refugee crises ever? You know, what can we do to leverage technology there? Likewise, you know, how do we continue to build on that health care clinic work in Zambia? What about our tribal communities here in Arizona and so forth?
Yeah, well, that's incredible. So, I mean, any advice? There's obviously a lot of money about to flow down from the federal government in the infrastructure bill. Any advice to the city leaders listening to this, especially around the broadband funding, the digital equity, how to maybe build a strategy that combines the two? Any advice for the cities looking at this money?
Well, again, you know, there's two ways for cities to look at the funds that are coming from Washington. The first is to understand that the overwhelming amount of the funds that are flowing in are actually block transfers from to state and state governors. And so that it's incumbent upon cities to actually fashion a relationship and help to try to shape how the states are approaching the distribution of those funds. And I can share with you from across the country, including here in Arizona, you know, that's definitely been a work in progress in the sense that, you know, no one was quite sure when the funds and how much of the funds and what the rules for distributing the funds were going to be. And there are some states that are actually extremely well practiced, having spent 20 or 25 years working on things like digital equity. But I think other states, you know, have been basically running as hard as they can to catch up and starting with a strategy that connects the city strategy to the state strategy. I think that's hugely important. I guess I would just say the other piece is, the second sort of vector is that there are competitive funds and very large competitive funds that cities are actually, you know, have already had a chance to compete for, and there's lots more funding coming. You know, the most important part here, from my vantage point, is to realize that for the first time ever, in any significant way, there are funds that are going to be dedicated through the Department of Commerce for digital equity, and they're substantial. And here the play is, and why I share this with your listeners, is that for the first time, states can't simply pick and choose kind of where those funds are going to go. They actually have to have a digital equity plan. They're actually being funded up front. States are being funded up front, about $5 million, and then a commitment to $100 million to actually deliver the plan, which is, say, community engagement before funds are distributed to actually execute on the plan. Wow. So the first money is plan to plan, then planning dollars, and all of that is all over the country is now creating, I think, very exciting dialogue between state broadband offices and state economic development offices and state departments of transportation, which have been the usual conduits for these activities, and now really trying to figure out, so what is the network of community organizations that need to come together to actually do this work? And again, here in Arizona, you know, I think we're doing a great job at making a run at that. Obviously, Dom, you know this all too well because you're the progenitor of much of our organizational efforts to do it through the Digital Equity Institute. I think, you know, we stand a reasonably good chance to help communities all Arizona, urban, rural, tribal, and in all geographies of the state, to actually help them with the planning of how they want to attend to their digital equity issues, which is to say, how do they want to use these funds to address their community's priorities around, again, I would say, working on poverty, the aged community, the disabled community. Those are the folks without broadband. That's it. I mean, those are the folks. Yeah. It's really about poverty alleviation. And otherwise, it's very, very, you know, selectively, you know, selective other value, at least in my mind. And obviously, you know, it's also at the same time the art of writing great grants and getting, you know, great testimonials as well.
Yeah. So my guess, you would highly recommend also that these governments, these leaders, reach out to the universities, because universities sounds like could be a big, big partner in helping them achieve these goals.
Indeed. And, you know, the best, you know, states in the nation have longstanding great relationships with their university partners, and who in turn oftentimes have very deep relationships with community organizations. Yeah. And again, the National Digital Inclusion Alliance, you know, led by Angela Siefer, you know, has been at this work, you know, again, for 20 years. And over, you know, she is, in my mind, not singularly, but certainly most importantly, responsible for work that used to be nothing, and I don't mean this in a derogatory way, but under the radar screen, at the grassroots community level, setting up computer labs across the country and creating networks of people working on these activities. You know, now we, you know, we have billions with a B dollars that she and her organization and the her board, you know, have been successfully working with the administration and the Department of Commerce to achieve. And you know, I'm going to make a suggestion for someone else for you guys to talk to, because I know that's one of your standard questions, because I've heard it enough time on your podcast. I'll hold that back, but go for it.
Cool. Well, you know, you've covered so much ground here, and I know, you know, ASU and you've built kind of an event to encapsulate our perspective, the Smart Region event. I think we've had the fourth iteration now. Tell with the audience what it is. How you've seen this work be a or how have you seen the region event be a catalyst for action? And what do you think is on the horizon?
Yeah, I mean, I really do think that universities. This goes back to Dom's, I think, really important insight, which is, you know, universities can play a convening role. There are, you know, there's in almost every city, you know, there are some technology leaders. They may or may not be involved civically. There are grassroots organizations which may or may not feel like actually they can get much visibility in the decision environment. There are mayors who may have true passion and commitment, but don't actually have agency capacity to actually execute them. Universities really are, I think, great conveners and have capacity to help execute. And so, you know, at ASU, you know, we've held a number of forums, starting with a particularly kind of local flavor, trying to help the community. And that first one, as I recall, you know, we invited a number of folks from across the city, let's say somewhere in the neighborhood of 350 or so, not only in the city, but beyond the city as well. We had lots of folks.
Including said mayor of Cleveland, by the way.
That's right. Well, the now mayor of Cleveland.
Right.
That's interesting. You're right, Chris. That was Justin Bibb, who's, again, a good friend of mine. And I know, Dom, you know him well as well. Was at that meeting, but also at that meeting. And Justin, by the way, as you'll recall, Chris, just to say it, you know, that panel was on digital equity.
Totally. Yeah. It was before it even hit me.
Before we, you know, before it was kind of a thing, right? Yeah. Wow. But also at that event, you know, we began, I think, working creatively with corporate partners and trying to also come together. And I think, you know, the Amazon Web Services commitment to work with ASU to actually build a cloud innovation center that was focused on leveraging the idea that if cities had challenges, that the university and, a global leading platform, a company, would come together to actually help engineer prototypes of ways in which those problems could be addressed using cloud technologies. That, in my mind, you know, was one of the most important seeds that got planted in that first Smart Cities regional gathering, Chris. And I think since then, we've always tried to pull a thread for how to be thinking about and both rather than either or propositions along the way. And, you know, I think we've also broadened the conversation. So this past year, we hosted as part of the program, in addition to great student voices and terrific community engagement, you know, we also worked on significant partnerships at the federal level with the National Task Force on the Future of Technology, specifically on digital equity, and we actually worked with them to give us a feel for the report out on their national commission. That you know got issued a couple of weeks after our meeting in January of this year.
Yeah,
that's great stuff. So we are to the standard question. Sounds like you've done your homework, but we have one that we didn't start the podcast with. We found really interesting outcomes with, and that's just if you had help to do more. Let's say the perfect guest was perfect audience member was listening, and they were set to do it. Whether it was opening a door to a connection or some sort of investment, how do you look at that question and what do you need to do more from where you're sitting?
Well, you know, I do believe that, you know, the network is our net worth. And I think that that really is a responsibility for all leaders. And certainly, you know, my responsibility in significant measure at ASU, again, because of our mission. And I do think that that's hugely important to take, you know, as many inbound inquiries as can be reasonably handled. Quickly try to, if I can't answer the questions, get them dispatched to the people who can and try to build, what I call the coalition of the willing.
Great. Yeah. So then now the last question, anyone you want to call out appreciatively and if they're a great fit for the show, we'd love to hear. So you've been doing this a long time. We'd love to know.
I thought about the question and honestly, and Dom knows this well, because I'm going to suggest the same person that I suggest for our gala dinner on digital equity here. And that is Angela Bennett. Angela is the first ever national leader for digital equity in the U.S. Department of Commerce, NTIA, the National Telecommunications Infrastructure Group. And she is a friend and a colleague. She just started her job today, Today I'm recording on April the 1st, and she's a colleague. She left Digital C on Friday of last week. So I think Angela would be terrific. She's going to be one of our keynotes at the Digital Equity Institute Gala dinner coming up at the end of this month.
Wow. With that, the Urban Complex gives a big note of thanks to today's guest, Lev Gonick, CIO of Arizona State University, and my boss. Thanks for joining us, Lev.
Thanks, Lev.
Bye, guys. Bye.
The Greater Phoenix Economic Council, known as GPEC, was named the top economic development organization in the U.S. in 2020. As a data-driven regional organization, GPEC serves as a strategic partner to companies across the world as they expand or relocate to other markets. Over the past 31 years, GPEC has fueled the Greater Phoenix economy by helping more than 850 companies and creating more than 154,000 jobs. Leaders in Greater Phoenix are building the nation's most innovative and connected smart region through The Connective. This community-driven applied research model deploys technology at scale. For more information about GPEC, visit gpec.org.
All right, Dom, that was Lev. What do you think?
Yeah, incredible. I mean, I knew he was going to be amazing. I've learned so much and I continue to learn so much. You know what really stood out for me, what I really want to kind of harp on is, I mean, just his incredible leadership. And he was right when he came in, the entire focus of ASU, at least from the perspective of the regional community, ASU's perspective shifted from just focusing on delivering IT services to students and the researchers on campus to this idea of leveraging the ASU, the campus infrastructure, to not only serve the campus and the students, but also the regional and broader community, right? And I think he said something pretty astounding, right? He kept saying, architect a network for the campus and beyond, right? So this idea of the role that a university and the influence that a university can have, not only within its campus boundaries, but outside into the broader community, I think that's an incredible leadership perspective. And I think once he brought that perspective to the ASU, it completely changed the trajectory of our region. And I think what's even more astounding is the fact that he doesn't sit there and just talk about connectivity for like connectivity's sake, but he constantly weaves in the purpose behind the connectivity, right? Connecting it to health, connecting it to education, connecting it to workforce development and government services, right? How can not only the campus infrastructure help support all of those important initiatives, but also, right, how can the campus be kind of this testing ground for it? And I think you kind of harped on that a little bit too, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, a lot of traditional IT is just a delivery organization.
True.
He said it's an and, not an either or. And I think most of the time, you know, IT would just say, all right, we're going to serve this research entity. We're going to do that for that. But to your point, if what you said, like if you create this network of networks and solve for ASU students, but at the same time, open up avenues for the research to do things that were unprecedented and or allow the broader community to plug in, like those are ants, and you bring them in. And it's interesting to see what it's done for Lev and our technology office. It's turned technology from a office to an enterprise technology approach. And in that way, Lev is now on one of the exec chairs, the EVPs. And so IT is at the table, and it's amazing to see because he's helping change their trajectory. He's adding value beyond just an IT service to an IT digital transformation engine, value provider. And it's not leading with tech. It's leading with how do we help, you know?
Yeah. And that influence, that leadership is just incredibly important to the surrounding cities. I mean, you know, I've sat in meetings with him where we're working on connecting a public housing unit in the city of Phoenix or a tribal community or, you know, a low-income refugee community, right? He's leveraging his knowledge, his expertise, his experience of building networks to actually help the communities that might not have that technical capacity, right? He sits, he's our technical chair of that broadband task force. So
it's really, and he said it, it's your network is your net worth, right?
Yeah.
He knows so many folks, he can bring that to the table too, or he can leverage ASU's network to bring it to the community. And what he does is, you heard him say, universities can play this convening role so they can get these cross groups together. And oh, by the way, if they have the right people involved, they have the capacity to help drive it forward. So it's the capacity to execute. So I think, it kind of showcases how ASU can be that, how a person like Lev can make it happen and add additive.
Yeah, I like that. The network used in both ways, right? The physical network, the infrastructure network, but also the people network, right? Because that Smart Region event started, I mean, pretty impressive, but it's continued to grow global, right? And it's brought people, partners, investors to our region where we didn't really have that before. So yeah, I love it.
Exactly.
Awesome. So shall we shift to cracks in the pavement? You have a good article for us today?
Let's do it. It's IDC names the 17 winners for its 2022 North America Smart City Award. And I think what's nice about this one is some folks we know, some cities we know made it. So I'm looking through the list. A couple I'll call out. City of Mesa, Arizona, smart buildings and their facilities automation. That's pretty cool.
Harry and Travis on that one. That's great. Yeah.
City of Syracuse. So Jen, the sustainable infrastructure. They did some lighting projects. I'm not sure if she was involved, but I would assume so. City of Pittsburgh is on here. Let's see. What's the project they did? Transportation infrastructure. So I'm sure that some folks we've had on before have been involved in that. But yeah, no, it's just great to see a lot of, they have things like violent crime focus. They have records management system. They have optic infrastructure. They have some data exchange work. So just a lot of innovation going on. So it's great to see all this recognition.
Yeah, that's awesome. That violent crime in City of Dallas, Jen Sanders, right? I mean, it's really cool. And I love, I love this because you could be a city leader scrolling through this list and say, hey, traffic data sharing, that's something I'm working on. Let's reach out to, Virginia Beach and see what we might be able to.
Well, and that's the beauty of these industries, right? They'll tell the story here on the urban complex, or they'll be open to a phone call if people are listening and you want to learn more. So, yeah.
Absolutely. That's awesome. Well, yep. Good article. I suggest people take a look and see if they might be able to find something that rings their bell.
Cool. Well, that's a wrap. See everybody soon. And thanks for joining us on the Urban Complex.
See you next time. Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Urban Complex, smarter cities for a stronger tomorrow. Please find us on where you listen, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube. We do love your feedback. Let us know if you have ideas for guests or questions to air on Cracks in the Pavement via social media. The Urban Complex is found on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter. Or just shoot me an email, chris@theurbancomplex.com. Till next time.